The Secret of Chimneys, Agatha Christie. Chapter 28. King Victor. "I suspected her from the first," explained Anthony. "There was a light in her room on the night of the murder. Afterwards, I wavered. I made inquiries about her in Brittany and came back satisfied that she was what she represented herself to be. I was a fool, because the Comtesse de Breteuil had employed a Mademoiselle Brun, and spoke highly of her. It had never occurred to me that the real Mademoiselle Brun might have been kidnapped on her way to her new post, and that it might be a substitute taking her place. Instead, I shifted my suspicions to Mr. Fish. It was not until he'd followed me to Dover, and we had had a mutual explanation, that I began to see clearly. Once I knew that he was a Pinkerton's man, trailing King Victor, my suspicions swung back again to their original object. The thing that worried me most was that Mrs. Revel had definitely recognized the woman. Then I remembered that it was only after I had mentioned her being Madame de Breteuil's governess, and all she had said was that that accounted for the fact that the woman's face was familiar to her. Superintendent Battle will tell you that a deliberate plot was formed to keep Mrs. Revel from coming to Chimneys. Nothing more nor less than a dead body, in fact. And though the murder was the work of the comrades of the Red Hand, punishing supposed treachery on the part of the victim, the staging of it, and the absence of the comrades' sign manual, pointed to some abler intelligence directing operations. From the first, I suspected some connection with Herzoslovakia. Mrs. Revel was the only member of the house party who'd been to the country. I suspected at first that someone was impersonating Prince Michael, but that proved to be a totally erroneous idea. When I realized the possibility of Mademoiselle Brun's being an impostor, and added to that the fact that her face was familiar to Mrs. Revel, I began to see daylight. It was evidently very important that she not be recognized, and Mrs. Revel was the only person likely to do so. But who was she? Said Lord Caddaham. Someone Mrs. Revel had known in Herzoslovakia? I think the Baron might be able to tell us, said Anthony. I? The Baron stared at him, then down at the motionless figure. Look well, said Anthony. Don't be put off by the makeup. She was an actress once, remember? The Baron stared again. Suddenly, he started. God in heaven, he breathed. It's not possible. What's not possible? Asked George. Who's the lady? You recognize her, Baron? No, it's not possible, the Baron continued to mutter. She was killed. They were both killed. On the steps of the palace, her body was recovered. Mutilated and unrecognizable, Anthony reminded him. She managed to put up a bluff. I think she escaped to America and has spent a good many years lying low in deadly terror of the comrades of the Red Hand. They promoted the revolution, remember, and to use an expressive phrase, they always had it in for her. Then, King Victor was released, and they planned to recover the diamond together. She was searching for it that night when she came suddenly upon Prince Michael, and he recognized her. There was never much fear of her meeting him in the ordinary way of things. Royal guests don't come in contact with governesses, and she could always retire with a convenient migraine, as she did the day the Baron was here. However, she met Prince Michael face to face when she least expected it. Exposure and disgrace stared her in the face. She shot him. It was she who placed the revolver in Isaacstein's suitcase so as to confuse the trail, and she who returned the letters. Lemoine moved forward. She was coming down to search for the jewel that night, you say, he said. Might she not have been going to meet her accomplice, King Victor, who was coming from outside? Eh? What do you say to that? Anthony sighed. Still at it, my dear Lemoine. How persistent you are. You won't take my hint that I've got a trump card up my sleeve? But George, whose mind worked slowly, now broke in. "I'm still completely at sea. Who was this lady, Baron? You recognize her, it seems." But the Baron drew himself up and stood very straight and stiff. "You are in error, Mr. Lomax. To my knowledge, I have not seen this lady before. A complete stranger she is to me. But..." George stared at him, bewildered. The Baron took him into the corner of the room and murmured something into his ear. Anthony watched with a good deal of enjoyment, George's face turning slowly purple, his eyes bulging, and all the incipient symptoms of apoplexy. A murmur of George's throaty voice came to him. "Certainly, certainly. By all means. No need at all. Complicate situation. Utmost discretion." "Ah!" Lemoine hit the table sharply with his hand. "I don't care about all this. The murder of Prince Michael, that was not my affair. I want King Victor." Anthony shook his head gently. "I'm sorry for you, Lemoine. You're really a very able fellow. But all the same, you're going to lose the trick. I'm about to play my trump card." He stepped across the room and rang the bell. Treadwell answered it. "A gentleman arrived with me this evening, Treadwell." "Yes, sir, a foreign gentleman." "Quite so. Will you kindly ask him to join us here as soon as possible?" "Yes, sir." Treadwell withdrew. "Entry of the trump card. The mysterious Monsieur X," remarked Anthony. "Who is he? Can anyone guess?" "Putting two and two together," said Herman Isaacstein, "what with your mysterious hints this morning and your attitude this afternoon, I should say there's no doubt about it. Somehow or other, you've managed to get hold of Prince Nicholas of Herzegovina. You think the same, Baron?" "I do. Unless yet another impostor you have put forward. But that I will not believe. With me, your dealings most honorable have been." "Thank you, Baron. I shan't forget those words. So, you're all agreed." His eyes swept around the circle of waiting faces. Only Lemoine did not respond, but kept his eyes fixed sullenly on the table. Anthony's quick ears had caught the sound of footsteps outside in the hall. "And yet, you know," he said with a queer smile, "you're all wrong." He crossed swiftly to the door and flung it open. A man stood on the threshold, a man with a neat black beard, eyeglasses, and a foppish appearance, slightly marred by a bandage round the head. "Allow me to present to you the real Monsieur Lemoine of the Sûreté." There was a rush and a scuffle, and then the nasal tones of Mr. Hiram Fish rose bland and reassuring from the window. "No, you don't, sonny, not this way. I have been stationed here this whole evening for the particular purpose of preventing your escape. You will observe that I have you covered well and good with this gun of mine. I came over to get you, and I've got you. But you sure are some lad." Chapter 29. Further Explanations. "You owe us an explanation, I think, Mr. Cade," said Herman Isaacstein, somewhat later in the evening. "There's nothing much to explain," said Anthony, modestly. "I went to Dover, and Fish followed me under the impression that I was King Victor. We found a mysterious stranger imprisoned there, and as soon as we heard his story, we knew where we were. The same idea again, you see. The real man kidnapped, and the false one, in this case King Victor himself, takes his place. But it seems that Battle here always thought there was something fishy about his French colleague, and wired to Paris for his fingerprints and other means of identification." "Ah!" cried the Baron. "The fingerprints! The Bertillon measurements that scoundrel talked about." "It was a clever idea," said Anthony. "I admired it so much that I felt forced to play it up. Besides, my doing so puzzled the false Lemoine enormously. You see, as soon as I had given the tip about the rose and where the jewel really was, he was keen to pass on the news to his accomplice, and at the same time, to keep us all in that room. The note was really to Mademoiselle Brune. He told Treadwell to deliver it at once, and Treadwell did so by taking it upstairs to the schoolroom. Lemoine accused me of being King Victor, by that means creating a diversion and preventing anyone from leaving the room. By the time all that had been cleared up, and we adjourned to the library to look for the stone, he flattered himself that the stone would no longer be there to find. George cleared his throat. "I must say, Mr. Cade," he said pompously, "that I consider your action in that matter highly reprehensible. If the slightest hitch had occurred in your plans, one of our national possessions might have disappeared beyond the hope of recovery. It was foolhardy, Mr. Cade, reprehensibly foolhardy." "I guess you haven't tumbled to the idea, Mr. Lomax," said the drawling voice of Mr. Fish, "that historic diamond was never behind the books in the library."
"Never?"
"Not on your life."
"You see," explained Anthony, "that little device of Count Stilpitch's stood for what it had originally stood for, a rose. When that dawned upon me on Monday afternoon, I went straight to the rose garden. Mr. Fish had already tumbled to the same idea. If, standing with your back to the sundial, you take 7 paces straight forward, then 8 to the left and 3 to the right, you come to some bushes of a bright red rose called Richmond. The house has been ransacked to find the hiding place, but nobody has thought of digging in the garden. I suggest a little digging party tomorrow morning. Then the story about the books in the library, an invention of mine to trap the lady. Mr. Fish kept watch on the terrace and whistled when the psychological moment had arrived. I may say that Mr. Fish and I established martial law at the Dover House and prevented the comrades from communicating with the false Lemoine. He sent them an order to clear out, and word was conveyed to him that this had been done. So he went happily ahead with his plans for denouncing me.
"Well, well," said Lord Caddaham cheerfully, "everything seems to have been cleared up most satisfactorily."
"Everything but one," said Mr. Isaacstein.
"What's that?"
The great financier looked steadily at Anthony.
"What did you get me down here for? Just to assist at a dramatic scene as an interested onlooker?"
Anthony shook his head.
"No, Mr. Isaacstein. You're a busy man whose time is money. Why did you come down here originally?"
"To negotiate a loan."
"With whom?"
"Prince Michael of Herzegovina."
"Exactly.
Prince Michael is dead."
"Are you prepared to offer the same loan, on the same terms, to his cousin, Nicholas?"
"Can you produce him? I thought he was killed in the Congo."
"He was killed, all right.
I killed him."
"Oh, no, I'm not a murderer. When I say I killed him, I mean that I spread the report of his death. I promise you a prince, Mr. Isaacstein."
"Will I do?"
"You?"
"Yes, I'm the man. Nicholas Sergius Alexander Ferdinand Obolovich. Rather long for the kind of life I propose to live, so I emerged from the Congo as plain Anthony Cade."
Little Captain Andrassy sprang up.
"But this is incredible, incredible," he sputtered. "Have a care, sir, what you say."
"I can give you plenty of proofs," said Anthony quietly. "I think I shall be able to convince the Baron here." The Baron lifted his hand.
"Your proofs I will examine, yes, but of them, for me, there is no need. Your word alone, sufficient for me, is. Besides, your English mother you much resemble. All along have I said, this young man on one side or the other most highly born is."
"You have always trusted my word, Baron," said Anthony. "I can assure you that in the days to come, I shall not forget." Then he looked over at Superintendent Battle, whose face had remained perfectly expressionless.
You can understand, said Anthony with a smile, that my position has been extremely precarious. Of all of those in the house, I might be supposed to have the best reason for wishing Michael Lobolovitch out of the way, since I was the next heir to the throne. I've been extraordinarily afraid of battle all along. I always felt that he suspected me, but that he was held up by lack of motive.
I never believed for a minute that you'd shot him, sir, said Superintendent Battle. We've got a feeling in such matters, but I knew that you were afraid of something, and you puzzled me. If I'd have known sooner who you really were, I dare say I'd have yielded to the evidence and arrested you. I'm glad I managed to keep one guilty secret from you. You wormed everything else out of me, all right. You're a damn good man at your job, Battle. I shall always think of Scotland Yard with respect.
Most amazing, muttered George. Most amazing story I ever heard. I can hardly believe it. You're quite sure, Baron, that...
My dear Mr. Lomax, said Anthony, with a slight hardness in his tone, I have no intention of asking the British Foreign Office to support my claim without bringing forward the most convincing documentary evidence. I suggest that we adjourn now, and that you, the Baron, Mr. Isaacstein, and myself discuss the terms of the proposed loan. The Baron rose to his feet and clicked his heels together. It will be the proudest moment of my life, sir, he said solemnly, when I see you, King of Herzegovina. Oh, by the way, Baron, said Anthony carelessly, slipping his hand through the other's arm, I forgot to tell you. There's a string tied to this. I'm married, you know.
The Baron retreated a step or two. Dismay overspread his countenance. Something wrong I knew there would be, he boomed. Merciful God in heaven, he's married a black woman in Africa.
Come, come, it's not so bad as all that, said Anthony, laughing. She's white enough. White all through, bless her.
Good. A respectable morganatic affair it can be, then.
Not a bit of it. She's to play queen to my king. It's no use shaking your head. She's fully qualified for the post. She's the daughter of an English peer who dates back to the time of the Conqueror. It's very fashionable just now for royalties to marry into the aristocracy, and she knows something of Herzegovina.
My God, cried George, startled out of his usual careful speech.
Not Virginia Revel.
Yes, said Anthony, Virginia Revel.
My dear fellow, cried Lord Cadaham, I mean, sir, I congratulate you. I do indeed. A delightful creature.
Thank you, Lord Cadaham, said Anthony. She's all you say and more.
But Mr. Isaacstein was regarding him curiously.
You'll excuse my asking, Your Highness, but when did this marriage take place?
Anthony smiled back at him.
As a matter of fact, he said, I married her this morning.
Chapter 30. Anthony signs on for a new job.
If you'll go on, gentlemen, I'll follow you in a minute, said Anthony. He waited while the others filed out, and then turned to where Superintendent Battle was standing, apparently absorbed in examining the paneling.
Well, Battle, want to ask me something, don't you?
Well, I do, sir, though I don't know how you knew I did. But I always marked you out as being specially quick in the uptake. I take it that the lady who's dead was the late Queen Viraga.
Quite right, Battle. It'll be hushed up, I hope. You can understand what I feel about family skeletons.
Trust Mr. Lomax for that, sir. No one will ever know. That is, a lot of people will know, but it won't get about.
Was that what you wanted to ask me about?
No, sir. That was only in passing. I was curious to know just what made you drop your own name, if I'm not taking too much of a liberty.
Not a bit of it, I'll tell you. I killed myself for the purest motives, Battle. My mother was English, I'd been educated in England, and I was far more interested in England than in Herzegovina. And I felt an absolute fool knocking about the world in a comic opera title tacked on to me. You see, when I was very young, I had democratic ideas, believed in the purity of ideals and the equality of all men. I especially disbelieved in kings and princes. And since then? Asked Battle shrewdly. Oh, since then, I've traveled and seen the world. There's damned little equality going about. Mind you, I still believe in democracy. But you've got to force it on people with a strong hand, ram it down their throats. Men don't want to be brothers. They may someday, but they don't now. My belief in the brotherhood of man died the day I arrived in London last week, when I observed people standing in a tube train resolutely refused to move up and make room for those who entered. You won't turn people into angels by appealing to their better natures just yet a while. But by judicious force, you can coerce them into behaving more or less decently to one another to go on with. I still believe in the brotherhood of man, but it's not coming yet a while. Say another 10,000 years or so. It's no good being impatient. Evolution is a slow process. I'm very interested in these views of yours, sir, said Battle with a twinkle. And if you'll allow me to say so, I'm sure you'll make a very fine king out there. Thank you, Battle, said Anthony with a sigh. You don't seem very happy about it, sir. Oh, I don't know. I dare say it'll be rather fun, but it's tying oneself down to regular work. I've always avoided that before. But you consider it your duty, I suppose, sir. Good Lord, no. What an idea. It's a woman. It's always a woman, Battle. I'd do more than be a king for her sake. Quite so, sir. I've arranged it so that the Baron and Isaacstein can't kick. The one wants a king, and the other wants oil. They'll both get what they want. And I've got... Oh, Lord, Battle, have you ever been in love? I am much attached to Mrs. Battle, sir. Much attached to Mrs. Oh, you don't know what I'm talking about. It's entirely different. Excuse me, sir. That man of yours is waiting outside the window. Boris? So he is. He's a wonderful fellow. It's a mercy that pistol went off in the struggle and killed the lady. Otherwise, Boris would have wrung her neck as sure as fate, and then you'd have wanted to hang him. His attachment to the Ibolovich dynasty is remarkable. The queer thing was that as soon as Michael was dead, he attached himself to me. And yet, he couldn't possibly have known who I really was. Instinct, said Battle, like a dog. Very awkward instinct, I thought at the time. I was afraid it might give the show away to you. I suppose I'd better see what he wants. He went out through the window. Superintendent Battle, left alone, looked after him for a minute, then apparently addressed the paneling. He'll do, said Superintendent Battle. Outside, Boris explained himself. Master, he said, and led the way along the terrace. Anthony followed him, wondering what was forward. Presently, Boris stopped and pointed with his forefinger. It was moonlight, and in front of them was a stone seat on which sat two figures. He is a dog, said Anthony to himself, and what's more, a pointer. He strode forward. Boris melted into the shadows. The two figures rose to meet him. One of them was Virginia. The other, Hello, Joe, said a well-remembered voice. This is a great girl of yours. Jimmy McGrath, by all that's wonderful, cried Anthony. How in the name of fortune did you get here? That trip of mine into the interior went foot. Then some dagos came monkeying around, wanted to buy that manuscript off me. Next thing, I, as near as nothing, got a knife in the back one night. That made me think that I'd handed you out a bigger job than I knew. I thought you might need some help, and I came along after you by the very next boat. Wasn't it splendid of him? Said Virginia. She squeezed Jimmy's arm. Why didn't you ever tell me how frightfully nice he was? You are, Jimmy. You're a perfect dear. You two seem to be getting along all right, said Anthony. Sure thing, said Jimmy. I was snooping round for news of you when I connected with this dame. She wasn't at all what I thought she'd be. Some swell, haughty society lady that'd scare the life out of me. He told me all about the letters, said Virginia, and I feel almost ashamed not to have been in real trouble over them when he was such a knight errant. If I'd known what you were like, said Jimmy gallantly, I'd not have given him the letters. I'd have brought them to you myself. Say, young man, is the fun really over? Is there nothing for me to do? By Jove, said Anthony, there is. Wait a minute. He disappeared into the house. In a minute or two, he returned with a paper package, which he cast into Jimmy's arms. Go round to the garage and help yourself to a fine-looking car. Beat it to London and deliver that parcel to 17 Everdeen Square. That's Mr. Balderson's private address. In exchange, he'll hand you £1,000. What? It's not the memoirs. I understood that they'd been burnt. What do you take me for? Demanded Anthony. You don't think I'd fall for a story like that, do you? I rang up the publishers at once, found out that the other was a fake call, and arranged accordingly. I made up a dummy package, as I'd been directed to do. But I put the real package in the manager's safe and handed over the dummy. The memoirs have never been out of my possession. Bully for you, my son, said Jimmy. Oh, Anthony, cried Virginia, you're not going to let them be published. I can't help myself. I can't let a pal like Jimmy down. But you needn't worry. I've had time to wade through them. And I see now why people always hint that bigwigs don't write their own reminiscences, but hire someone to do it for them. As a writer, Stilpitch is an insufferable bore. He proses on about statecraft and doesn't go in for any racy and indiscreet anecdotes. His ruling passion of secrecy held strong to the end. There's not a word in the memoirs from beginning to end to flutter the susceptibilities of the most difficult politician. I rang up Balderson today and arranged with him that I'd deliver the manuscript tonight, before midnight. But Jimmy can do his own dirty work now that he's here. I'm off, said Jimmy. I like the idea of that £1,000, especially when I'd made up my mind it was down and out. Half a second, said Anthony. I've got a confession to make to you, Virginia, something that everyone else knows, but that I haven't yet told you. I don't mind how many strange women you've loved, as long as you don't tell me about them. Women, said Anthony with a virtuous air. Women, indeed! You ask James here what kind of women I was going about with the last time he saw me. Frumps, said Jimmy solemnly. Utter frumps. Not one a day under 45. Thank you, Jimmy, said Anthony. You're a true friend. No, it's much worse than that. I've deceived you as to my real name. Is it very dreadful? Said Virginia with interest. It isn't something silly like Pobbles, is it? Fancy being called Mrs. Pobbles. You're always thinking the worst of me. I admit that I did once think you were King Victor, but only for about a minute and a half. By the way, Jimmy, I've got a job for you. Gold prospecting in the rocky fastnesses of Herzoslovakia. Is there gold there? Asked Jimmy eagerly. Sure to be, said Anthony. It's a wonderful country. So you're taking my advice and going there? Yes, said Anthony. Your advice was worth more than you knew. Now, for the confession. I wasn't changed at nurse, or anything romantic like that, but nevertheless, I am really Prince Nicholas Obolovich of Herzoslovakia. Oh, Anthony, cried Virginia, how perfectly screaming! And I married you! What are we going to do about it? We'll go to Herzoslovakia and pretend to be king and queen. Jimmy McGrath once said that the average life of a king or queen out there is under 4 years. I hope you don't mind. Mind? Cried Virginia. I shall love it. Isn't she great? Murmured Jimmy. Then, discreetly, he faded into the night. A few minutes later, the sound of a car was heard. Nothing like letting a man do his own dirty work, said Anthony with satisfaction. Besides, I didn't know how else to get rid of him. Since we were married, I've not had 1 minute alone with you. We'll have a lot of fun, said Virginia, teaching the brigands not to be brigands, and the assassins not to assassinate, and generally improving the moral tone of the country. I like to hear these pure ideals, said Anthony. It makes me feel my sacrifice has not been in vain.
Rot, said Virginia calmly. You'll enjoy being a king. It's in your blood, you know. You were brought up to the trade of royalty, and you've got a natural aptitude for it, just like plumbers have a natural bent for plumbing.
I never think they have, said Anthony. But damn it all, don't let's waste time talking about plumbers. Do you know that at this very minute, I'm supposed to be deep in conference with Isaacstein and old Lollipop? They want to talk about oil.
Oil? My God, they can just wait my kingly pleasure.
Virginia, do you remember my telling you once that I'd have a damn good try to make you care for me?
I remember, said Virginia softly. But Superintendent Battle was looking out the window.
Well, he isn't now, said Anthony. He caught her suddenly to him, kissing her eyelids, her lips, the green gold of her hair.
I do love you so, Virginia, he whispered. I do love you so. Do you love me?
He looked down at her, sure of the answer. Her head rested against his shoulder, and very low, in a sweet, shaken voice, she answered,
"Not a bit."
"You little devil," cried Anthony, kissing her again. "Now I know for certain that I shall love you until I die."
Chapter 31. Sundry Details.
Scene. Chimneys. 11 a.m. Thursday morning. Johnson, the police constable, with his coat off, digging. Something in the nature of a funeral feeling seems to be in the air. The friends and relations stand round the grave that Johnson is digging. George Lomax has the air of the principal beneficiary under the will of the deceased. Superintendent Battle, with his immovable face, seems pleased that the funeral arrangements have gone so nicely. As the undertaker, it reflects credit upon him. Lord Caddaham has that solemn and shocked look which Englishmen assume when a religious ceremony is in progress. Mr. Fish does not fit into the picture so well. He is not sufficiently grave. Johnson bends to his task. Suddenly, he straightens up. A little stir of excitement passes round.
"That'll do, Sonny," said Mr. Fish. "We shall do nicely now."
One perceives at once that he's really the family physician. Johnson retires. Mr. Fish, with due solemnity, stoops over the excavation. The surgeon is about to operate. He brings out a small canvas package. With much ceremony, he hands it to Superintendent Battle. The latter, in his turn, hands it to George Lomax. The etiquette of the situation has now been carefully complied with. George Lomax unwraps the package, slits up the oil silk inside it, burrows into further wrapping. For a moment, he holds something on the palm of his hand, then quickly shrouds it once more in cotton wool. He clears his throat. "At this suspicious moment," he begins, with the clear delivery of the practiced speaker, Lord Caddaham beats a precipitate retreat. On the terrace, he finds his daughter.
"Bundle, is that car of yours in order?"
"Yes, why?"
"Then take me up to town in it immediately. I'm going abroad at once, today."
"But, Father—"
"Don't argue with me, Bundle. George Lomax told me when he arrived this morning that he was anxious to have a few words with me privately on a matter of the utmost delicacy. He added that the King of Timbuktu was arriving in London shortly. I won't go through it again, Bundle, do you hear? Not for 50 George Lomaxes. If Chimneys is so valuable to the nation, let the nation buy it. Otherwise, I shall sell it to a syndicate and they can turn it into a hotel."
"Where's Cotter's now?"
Bundle is rising to the situation.
"At the present minute," replied Lord Caddaham, looking at his watch, "he's good for at least 15 minutes more about the Empire."
Another picture. Mr. Bill Eversley, not invited to be present at the graveside ceremony, at the telephone.
"No, really, I mean it. I say, don't be huffy. Well, you will have supper tonight, anyway?"
"No, I haven't. I've been kept to it with my nose at the grindstone. You've no idea what Cotter's is like. I say, Dolly, you know jolly well what I think about you. You know I've never cared for anyone but you.
Yes, I'll come to the show first. How does the old wheeze go? And the little girl tries, hooks and eyes, unearthly sounds. Mr. Eversley trying to hum the refrain in question. And now, George's peroration draws to a close. The lasting peace and prosperity of the British Empire. I guess, said Mr. Hiram Fish, sotto voce to himself and the world at large, that this has been a great little old week. The end.